Welcome to another episode of the Left Curve podcast. Today, I have with myself Brandon from the Treehouse Finance. Now, the Left Curve is an attempt from Rear Block to make crypto and Web3 knowledge possessed by industry experts and thought leaders accessible to masses in simple terms without the jargon. And Brandon here, understanding fixed income is not straightforward for the average user, especially in Web3. Now, with Treehouse Protocol, you and your team have embarked on a very ambitious mission to simplify and innovate the DeFi fixed income market. And fixed income resonates deeply with our listeners that are new and want to make very informed judgments in this space. Probably they're coming in for the first time. Maybe they've heard about, GOAT or Fartcoin, and they're like, okay, I should check out Web3. Or maybe they've been burned in 2021 after the crash and they're re-entering the space. So we thought, you'd be the perfect guest to come in and shed light on this crucial aspect as well. Now, before we start, of course, let me preface by saying this, that none of what we say is financial advice. We're just crypto enthusiasts on the internet. Please do your own research before making any sort of investments. Quick background from my end. My name is Adonis. I'm one of the co-founders at Rear Block today. Blingo is not joining us, unfortunately, because he's busy vacationing. It's the 24th of December being recorded, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. So, Xmas Eve, here we are in the trenches. So, this is a little bit about me. Brandon, how about we go with an introduction from your end as well?
Sounds good. Really nice meeting you, Adonis, and thanks for having me on the podcast. Quick intro myself. So I'm Brandon. I'm one of the co-founders of Treehouse. Background-wise, prior to this, I was at Morgan Stanley doing credit derivatives and a bit of asset-backed finance. So very TradFi background. We started Treehouse about 4 years ago, and really it's the goal of bridging traditional finance principles into crypto. Very excited again to be here and looking forward to chat a bit more about what we're building as well as, how fixed income can change the space.
Amazing. And as I sip on this beautiful, lovely coffee, I'd also like to tell people that how this podcast is going to flow. So we're going to break this down into two phases. In the first phase, we'll just explore the foundations of fixed income and touch a little bit about Treehouse and its impact. In the second phase, which is like the deep dive one, we're going to get into the nitty gritty details as well. So I think let's start off from the phase one questions, right? So first of all, Brandon, tell us more about this notion of fixed income and in a space which is as changing, as volatile as crypto, how are we arriving at this, optimistic utopian solution of fixed income as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way to look at fixed income is that to think of it as a, within the car world, like a Toyota Corolla. It doesn't really grab anyone's attention, but it's usually very dependable, helps you get from point A to B very safely and quite predictably. So taking a bit step back, you look at all the different asset classes that exist in traditional finance, fixed income can be categorized as basically the Toyota of the investment world. It's the umbrella that houses a lot of financial instruments that a lot of retail or people that don't even know that they're holding these instruments. It could be like your mortgage, whether it's a student loan debt. But it's, or even from the other perspective of an investment where it pays out interest very reliably, it's, the kind of investment that would make your grandmother smile. And I guess, when we're touching into this topic, and we are in crypto after all, a lot of people would say, who wants a Toyota when you can have a Lambo, right? We're all about, when Lambo today, getting the idea of, anything more less than 100x is not as appealing. So believe it or not, I mean, if you look into all the asset classes in traditional finance, fixed income is actually the largest. It's 5 times larger than equities. Most people, when they think about investments, they think about, like Tesla. But fixed income is a massive, massive spot in space. And bringing it back to crypto, and you look at all the asset classes that exist in crypto since, Bitcoin came out, you have, spot trading, you have options, you have perpetuals. You don't really see a lot of fixed income. So that's really what we're trying to bring into the space. And we think that fixed income can make waves in the space and in a lot of good ways, whether it's just bringing, again, coming back to the idea of safe and predictable returns back to into this space and helping it to mature.
Very interesting idea, especially with the Toyota Corolla example. Big fan of Toyota Corollas as well and the reliability they bring along. And I think it's true what you just mentioned that, why have A Corolla when you can have like a Lambo. I think most people don't understand like how quickly people traverse through the 6 years of the cycle. Just like you can never time the bottom or you can never time the exact top. And I think crypto as an industry is wrought with people's stories of taking it and then losing it all because, you know, they round tripped and they never took profits at all, or they never parked their investments in a more, safer option altogether. So you did mention that, you know, you come from like a traditional finance background as well. So before we kind of dive deep into like Treehouse and, you know, how fixed income works, what made you leave the traditional finance world? I mean, a lot of people, they assume that, you know, once they get into finance, it's like a one-way ticket to, you know, financial freedom and, you know, everything that you get promised by movies like, you know, Wolf of Wall Street and so on and so forth. So what made you like, you know, depart from that position?
Yeah, very interestingly, you know, I was in the sales and trading world, right? So it's exactly what you mentioned, where kind of like Wolf of Wall Street-ish, not exactly, not as exciting, but it is that world. And I was actually against, I won't say against, but I wasn't really fond of crypto during the, you know, when I was starting out in a career. And that's, again, before like the pre-DeFi summer world. I kind of looked at it as, you know, just a new technology, where it's going to head to, I was pretty unsure. But that all changed for me when Uniswap was born. So that was really my, you know, aha moment, because I sat on the credit market making desk at Morgan Stanley, right? So the concept of Uniswap being automated market maker resonated for me. The moment I read the white paper to the moment I tried it, I'm like, wow, literally crypto just abstracted away my job, right? And it did it in a way through smart contracts. So that was really, that was mind-blowing for me. And that opened the door for me to looking into all the different iterations of DeFi Summer. And one thing led to another. I was heavily involved every day after work. I was just trading DeFi. I didn't even care about my work at one point in time. Just actively trading and trying all the new funky protocols. And during my time there, I mean, just trading during the nights, I started building a portfolio management solution for myself to emulate what I had on the trading desk. And that actually kind of opened the door for us to start of how we started Treehouse. So we started off purely as actually a portfolio management solution. So that yeah, I guess like really getting into the technology, starting with AMM, it just opened the door for me to this world and never left since. What about you? I'm actually curious to hear, like, how did you...
To be very honest with you, one of my seniors in college actually like pinged me about this revolutionary protocol known as Olympus DAO, and the rest is history, right? So I went into Ohm pretty heavy, pretty early on. But, you know, as you mentioned, Uniswap, I think that has been like the watershed moment for like most of the people, especially V2 and V3. When their white papers kind of came out. So I think one of the introductory mandatory readings for anyone entering Web3 is the white papers to kind of get like the foundational knowledge in place. So very interesting that you also mentioned that you reading that AMM or like using that AMM kind of led to the portfolio management system, which in turn led to you guys finding Treehouse down the line as well. Kind of interesting to note that butterfly effect as well going on there. But I'm assuming that, you know, when you started out, you were just like dabbling into it a little bit, right? Like not going like full out, of course, like paying more attention, like Morgan Stanley, the serious job. And then over time, it kind of won you over, right? So you did mention that you guys started off as like a portfolio management system. So how the switch of fixed income kind of comes into play? Were there like other competitors in the space? Or like, what was the landscape looking like for like fixed income, and like why the pivot in some sense?
Got it. So actually, it's not a pivot. We still have both businesses. So when you think of Treehouse, there's really two arms. But one is very institutional focused, which is the portfolio management solution, and then the other side is DeFi, fixed income infrastructure that we have. Now, what I would say is that how do they kind of relate to one another? Is that when I like to go back to the story of, like Bloomberg. Bloomberg is one of the biggest financial data powerhouses out there. When they first started, they were a solution for actually like fixed income traders, and just getting data. When we were building, so the solutions that we built, it wasn't specific to retail. You know, we were building like institutional grade portfolio management solutions. And we realized that there is a missing, just through our conversations with so many institutions, we felt that there was a gap in this space, right? And the entire gap is basically fixed income. And I think I broadly mentioned it where I said, you know, in crypto today, like fixed income doesn't really exist at all. I mean, or the notion of it does exist, but in terms of the kind of infrastructure, the base layer underlying it, you don't have anything like the benchmark rate, for example. So we thought, you know, I thought that that's just a huge gap that we needed to solve.
Very interesting. And I think we keep coming back to this idea of, you know, that infrastructure not existing in the first place. So is this something like, which is like Treehouse's mission as well, to kind of A, create the base layer, and B, create like the front-facing dApp as well, in your case?
Yeah, sure. So when, you know, what we call ourselves Treehouse, we call ourselves the decentralized fixed income layer. So we want to be a framework to power this fixed income in a decentralized space. So in the traditional finance world, all the instruments that you talk about, whatever, mortgages or loans, they have something called a benchmark rate. So we've basically ported that idea into the decentralized world. And the idea is that, you know, there is no central bank per se. There is no, you know, centralized authority to say, let's use this benchmark rate. So we've built a mechanism to incentivize multiple stakeholders to work together to build a decentralized benchmark rate. So that is essentially the solution that we have, or the bigger vision, which is to build this benchmark that, you know, other protocols can be built on top of us. Yeah.
Got it. And just for like our understanding as well, how would fixed income work in a traditional finance world? If you can like give us like a high level overview, I am of the impression that, of course, this benchmark rate plays a very important role. But exactly behind the scenes, what is happening that is allowing this fixed income to exist at the first place?
Yeah. So for fixed income to exist, you know, let's go back way back historically. Right. Let's go back to the early days of society. So the construct of money, right? So there's, I mean, Bitcoin kind of like represents that, right? It's a construct of trust, right? Everyone comes together and say, hey, there's trust in this, and then there's value underlying this asset behind, right? And it's a scarce good. Credit, the idea of credit, the idea of fixed income came about when people started, you know, borrowing from each other. So, you know, going to just my neighbor and saying, hey, can I borrow this from you? And I'll return something back in it later on, right? And before that, it was bartering, right? It was trading. So what is really required is a lot of trust between society. And underpinning all these fixed income instruments are standards that people have agreed to, whether it's like legal standards to say, you know, I'll return you your money back. If you don't have that construct of, you know, a legal contract, for example, in the traditional finance world, I'll just take your money and I'll disappear the next day and I won't come back and, you know, there's no recourse, right? So there are a lot of, you know, infrastructure that's required for this whole entire asset class to exist. And I'll circle it back to trust. Trust is a very, very big construct. And I mentioned already, like, legal contracts. In, you know, how we're trying to make it work in the DeFi world, it's through smart contracts. So trust in that layer of where, you know, you'll return your money back, or there will be a return of, or some sort of return behind it. Yeah.
Got it. And I think, you know, definitely trust is, it's kind of funny because in DeFi, we hear a lot about code is law, but even then we have like some trust between parties, at least between like deployer, like the overall product team and so on and so forth, right? So we are working on that, ironing out those details more as like an industry altogether, especially because we are really proud of saying that we live in trustless execution environments altogether, right? But I think this has been like the overall surface level talk. I think like we can now go into like the deep dive in some sense, right?
So when somebody looks at like Treehouse ecosystem, they, you know, we look at TSS, we've got DOR. So there are like different variables, different terms, you know, that are within the nitty-gritty details of Treehouse. Can you unpack these a little bit? I'm pretty sure this has something to do with the, you know, standardized rate that you were talking about that you're trying to emulate in Web3 by like social consensus. So can you explain to us how this works as well?
Yeah, for sure. So there's really two components of the Treehouse protocol. The first of which you mentioned is called T-Asset. And the second component, it's called Decentralized Offered Rates, or DOR for short. They're very much intertwined. And in fact, one powers the other. But I'll have to slowly explain into like the nitty-gritty details of how they intertwine. Let's start with T-Asset. And really to understand it, we need to understand what the landscape is like in crypto today. When you look at borrowing and lending rates on chain today, I think one big problem that still persists is the idea of fragmentation. And what does fragmentation mean? So fragmentation, let me explain it in a simpler context of just apples, right? Imagine being at, you know, a fruit market. You come across some branded apples, you know, is a specific brand on it, and you buy them for a price of like $10. You walk a few steps, you see another store come up, and you see the exact same apples from the same brand selling for $8. That's literally the space that we're in right now, within borrowing and lending rate. If you're borrowing ETH, you can look at one protocol and then they'll be giving you a 2% rate. The next protocol you go across will be giving you at 10%. There's a lot of fragmentation, right? And that's just a function of how we are in the space because we're still very early. But that is also very frustrating for a user, right? It's very hard to be in a space where there's all these different opportunities and, you know, you have to think through them every single time. And it tells you, fragmentation tells you one thing about the state of the market as well, is that there's a lack of consensus regarding the market price. In my scenario, apples, making it difficult for like consumers without knowledge or access to the clearing price to be able to do the right trades. Beyond that, it also shows like, you know, the Apple merchants not coming to agreement with each other of how much Apple should be priced at. So this concept of fragmentation is a big problem, and T-Asset is going out there to solve it. And we're solving it by looking at it from in a form of borrowing and lending rates. So now take away the construct of apples and put it and replace it with borrowing and lending ETH, for example. Across platforms today, like Aave, Spark, you know, at times you can do $50 to $100 million worth of borrowing where there is an arbitrage opportunity there. So what T-Asset does is that it acts as a smart trader for you, and it helps you to arbitrage between these Apple stores and provides you the best price. So think of us as a liquid staking token with an embedded strategy in there to help you find the best rate possible. So that's really the T-Asset side. Again, it's you know, if you want to go a bit deeper, you know, all of it, it's done by code. It's essentially a strategy that looks and tries to sieve out information from all these protocols to figure out the best place to borrow and lend, and then to arbitrage, and then therefore effectively giving the user the market clearing rate or the theoretically the safest rate out there in the market. T-Asset, we started it off strictly with ETH, Ethereum, because I mean, that's the first iteration for T-Asset. So what happens from a user perspective is that a user takes the ETH, they pass it to, you know, the contract, they receive T-ETH in return. So T-ETH is this receipt contract, which is redeemable for the original ETH and the additional yield that I'm about to talk about. The yield is generated by a smart contract strategy that dynamically optimizes between staking ETH into the proof of stake system, and then the interest rate arbitrage strategy on lending protocols that I was talking about. Effectively, this enables a baseline yield equivalent to native ETH staking. So think of your STETH, while also capturing additional returns from all these inefficiencies that I mentioned. So I hope I didn't, you know, I didn't go too deep into the details, but that's really the key assets. You know, happy to answer a bit more questions if you think, you know, we can go.
Yeah.
I think I would have just like two questions. Number one is, you guys started off with ETH. Can this, I know that we may not be able to get like native staking part right with this asset, but can we do it with stable coins is my first question. Considering like, you know, interest rate variability would still exist there across different lending and borrowing platforms. And number two would be, these lending and borrowing platforms, can you shed some more light as to like which ones have you guys whitelisted? I'm assuming that you guys would have to like whitelist these on the back end, like, you know, Aave, Morpho, or a couple of others. So yeah, those would be just my two questions. And then we can move on to like the second part of the question.
Yeah, for sure. So from a stablecoin perspective, definitely, right? I mean, it's not just limited to ETH where you see this fragmentation of the market. When you look at, say, Spox USDS compared to usuals rate, compare it to just all the other stablecoin protocols that are out there, the rates differ. The difference, however, here is that while, yes, we can do that, we ultimately, from a fixed income perspective, you want to start at where the safest return stems from. So from an ETH perspective, I like to think of it as proof of stake, because proof of stake is, it's almost like buying a government bond in a way, because you are giving ETH to the proof of stake system to then power it and to make it decentralized. So it's very, very safe and secure theoretically. And it, if technically proof of stake dies, the whole Ethereum system dies. So, you know, you might as well put it there as anywhere else safer, right? There's not many other places that's safer. When you talk about stable coins, however, a lot of times control is not in the control of the protocols that are building them, right? It comes back to the government that have issued the underlying behind it. So when you talk about USDT, USDC, yes, they live on-chain. Yes, there's inherent borrowing lending rates. The real risk-free rate from a stablecoin perspective is actually the U.S. government bond, right? For example, for when we talk about USD stablecoins. So it's a bit harder one, and I think it opens the Pandora box of a lot of discussions behind it. But that's why we also started with ETH, where it's a bit easier to explain, it's a bit more inherent to crypto, and stablecoin has a lot more influence behind it. The second part of your question, yes, we had to white label specific protocols, and we've started with the safest ones, right? Right now, we're only on Aave, right? And the scale of Aave, you know, it's around 20 billion in TVL, so just Aaving that itself is already enough for us, but we have coded in basically all the other similar protocols. So them, some of them being Spark, Compound, and Morpho. Yeah.
Very interesting. I think now we can move to, the DOR side of the equation. But I'm assuming that you practically already covered it in your key asset explanation with regards to, of course, there being like different offer rates.
Yeah. So the idea of DOR is it's really just a decentralized benchmark rate. And on first view, you can't really see too much of a relation between TAsset and DOR. And I'll slowly get into how they relate to one another. But DOR, like some context behind DOR, we started building DOR about 2 years ago. And I actually went up to Chainlink. I have a few close friends over there, and ask them, hey, is there a way that we can work with Chainlink to build a decentralized benchmark rate? They were pretty excited. You know, we had a few discussions, and at the end of the discussions, we realized that, okay, Chainlink's model couldn't really suit the needs of what we're trying to build. I went to BAN Protocol next. If you guys recall, BAN Protocol back in the day was one of the second largest Oracle, pioneered a lot of principles of Oracles as well. One of the co-founders went to university with me, so a close friend as well, had the same questions for him, got the same response. And, you know, both guys, my friends, both in Chainlink and BAN said, hey, why don't you guys just build it yourself? And, you know, I can advise you on the site. So that's how the idea of DOR, that's how we started building it. And the best way to explain door is actually to explain it from a traditional finance perspective and why it's very important. Let's go back, in fact, to the 1980s, because crypto kind of reminds me of the fixed income space in the 1980s. In the 1980s, you could get a mortgage. You know, you could get a fixed rate loan. You can get, there was student debt over back then, credit card. You're able to kind of just borrow money in general. But in that time period, the fixed income market wasn't that big. I mentioned in the start that fixed income markets today in traditional finance, it's almost 5 times larger than equities today. But in the 1980s, it was comparable in size. Why was it not as big as today? Was because at that point of time, benchmark rates didn't really exist. And I'm trying to give you the view of why benchmark rates are important in having them in a DeFi world. So when you look at, you get a mortgage from, say, Citibank, and you get your term sheet, and it says, okay, I borrowed this much money, and this is the rate that you're using. If you read a bit deeper, a lot of people don't read, but you read a lot deeper, there's usually a reference that will be there, and it's a benchmark or a type of methodology that is used to calculate this interest rate. And Citibank at that point in time would have their own benchmark. They'll just derive a methodology. If you go to Bank of America, if you pull out their term sheet, it would have a similar structure, but the reference would be like a Bank of America reference rate. And it kind of goes back to the idea of fragmentation. If, all these banks had their own ways of calculating different interest rates, that when they lend you money for your house, they had to warehouse that risk. They would hold that, that risk, the loan, just on their balance sheet, and they'll hold it all the way until the life, a lot of the time, throughout the life of that loan. That's not very efficient, right? The idea of, fixed income today is that once you do these loans can be packaged and be traded the same way that you can trade, a stock, right? A Tesla stock, for example. So that all changed in 1981 when LIBOR was born. So there's this benchmark called London Interbank Offered Rate. And in the finance world, it's a huge thing, but probably a lot of retail don't really see that term too much. But in 1981, when LIBOR was born, it changed the game of fixed income. And from then on, you just saw a hockey puck in terms of volumes in fixed income, where and the change was very simple. It was that the Federal Reserve or a lot of governments and associations came together and said, why not let's just unify all these benchmark rates, right? Such that Citibank, Bank of America can use the same methodology. And when they did that, all of a sudden people could hedge it out and, you could recycle your money very easily. And that opened the door to a whole bunch of fixed income instruments that just were born the following years after LIBOR was born. So DOR is essentially trying to be, this benchmark rate methodology that unifies, all the ways of calculating fixed income instruments or deriving fixed income instruments in crypto. And it's a way, it's a methodology, it's a standard that we're trying to create. So now that's a bit more on the context. Let's go a bit into DOR. When you look at DOR, the way I would explain it is that it's LIBOR, the principles of LIBOR, which is how traditional benchmarks are built. We put it into, we've added in blockchain principles. So we've added in staking, slashing. So it's a bit more trustless. We've added in new stakeholders. There's 5 stakeholders that work together to power this mechanism. And the idea is that, as more and more stakeholders are incentivized to participate, including people who hold T assets, can stake into specific actors in the DOR space. And then collectively, DOR can then power a whole new suite of instruments that doesn't exist today.
Got it. I think that was probably one of the most well-defined and structured, history lessons I've gotten as well about, how we have come to the origination of fixed income as well, especially with your examples of term sheets, different rates, but all of them having a very unified approach in terms of where they're deriving this rate from. I think you guys are like on a mission to not only like introduce fixed income, but also like build out the core infrastructure, which is necessary for fixed income to exist in the first place, right? Whether that's via Chainlink, whether that's via band protocol, those are like a separate question altogether. But tell me a little bit about, you know, any milestones that you guys have already been seeing recently at Treehouse Finance, and also like what's next and what's upcoming? What can like our viewers, if, you know, decide to keep monitoring Treehouse? You can give us them like a little bit of an alpha that, okay, this is something that we are working towards correctly.
Yeah, for sure. So, so Treehouse launched to the public in mid-September, so close to 3 months ago. And, you know, the day one when we launched, we hit 30 million in TBL, which is our cap, within less than 5 hours, which was amazing, you know, in terms of the interest. Today, you know, 3 months later, we're somewhere around the 300 million TBL range, and that's continuing to grow. You know, across the type of T assets that we have around 15,000 unique holders, which is, you know, comparable to some of the biggest protocols out there. So we've grown quite quickly, quite fast, and you know that's just the beginning, because you know there's a lot more to expect from us in 2025. The first thing I would say, you know, kind of park it into the T asset front, is that you're gonna see. It's not a secret. It's actually on our front page. You'll see there's going to be multiple types of T assets on different blockchains. So we're going to be launching a few different ones in the next 1 to 2 months, powering and actually working with the foundations themselves, because, you know, they take fixed income very seriously as well. On the other side, Door Mainnet is going to go live in Q1 as well. We have signed over 15 partners, from exchanges to data providers, to large staking houses, you know, some of the biggest like Kiln, you know, RockX, A41, you know, we're talking to practically all of them. And, you know, for them, the idea of e-staking is very simple right now, because a user just stakes ETH for them and they receive this yield that is fluctuating all the time. What they're interested in and why they're working with us is that they can potentially now be a way to fix, basically a fixed income of ETH staking. And DOR is helping to power that. We're not just going to be launching Ethereum for DOR. It's going to be on multiple blockchains. Again, working with those foundations. So very exciting. And yeah, I mean, from that perspective, like, you know, we're cooking a lot of things. You're going to see a lot coming up. We're also going to be launching a new instrument, without sharing too much, is a new type of fixed income instrument. It doesn't exist in crypto today. We're working with several big market makers, some of the biggest. The announcements will be coming out sometime in January. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of interest from hedge funds that we're working with, that are interested to trade this product just for, you know, just to help them manage their exposure in general. Again, fixed income is a lot about it, you know, helping to make their returns a bit safer, a bit more predictable. So that, yeah, you know, we're going to try and bootstrap a whole new market to exist. And I think, you know, 2025 is a good year for DeFi to see a whole new asset class.
Very, very interesting developments. I really look forward to the, you know, to the development of this new financial instrument that you guys are also building out. And it gave us quite a tease. You know, we're super excited for what you guys announced in 2025. I think you mentioned A41 there, and, you know, that kind of brings me back to like a topic I touch quite regularly, even when I'm reading in like my personal time, which is like LRTFi. I see you guys have already like partnered up with like EtherFi and a couple of them as well. I think something, at least as long as it goes with the ETH staking reward side of the equation, for generating that yield that a lot of people can get with their T assets, LRT protocols would be pretty interesting for to also like partner up with. So how are you leveraging, you know, these LRTFi side of the equation, you know, like EtherFi and a couple of others as well?
Yeah, sure. Exactly. You know, we have a partnership where we're part of the 12 days of Haze, this basically reward program that EtherFi has. They've been great partners of us. We also talk to majority of the other LRTs. I would say, we definitely fit in very much so into helping them from an underlying perspective, but not directly. So say you get, say you hold an LRT like ETH or RS ETH, right? Whichever one of those ETHs. The idea of hedging is still the same, which is that a component of LRT, one big part of it is ETH proof of stake. And then the other component is the ABS. So if you break down the return profile of LRTs, there's really just two subsets. And when you look at, fixed income instruments in traditional finance, it's similar. There is the risk-free component, which I call the ETH proof of stake side. And then there's the credit risk side, which is, when you, take on additional risks on top of what the government supposedly is the risk-free rate, right? It's the same story for LRTs. Investors that we're talking to always wanted to find ways to hedge out that, any kind of volatility, right? So working with us, hedge funds that hold these assets, these LRTs, can actually hedge out this component, the bottom component, which is the ETH proof of stake component. And then they can then directionally trade on the ABS side. So yeah, we definitely fit into that field, maybe not directly, but indirectly.
Yeah, I think that just speaks to like the composable nature of what you guys are building at Treehouse. And at the beginning you mentioned that you want Treehouse to be something on top of which other protocols build. And I think this is like one early facet of that. Sooner than later, we'll see, more dedicated protocols and platforms being built on top of you guys. I think that kind of moves us towards, a little bit towards the end of the podcast, which is like, what advice would you give to someone who is now, watching this episode? They're quite pumped up. They're very interested, of course, in this fixed income side of the equation. So they want to enter the field of fixed income in Web3, given that you've gathered so much experience. Now, this person may not come from a traditional finance background as strong as you. So any tips, any tricks that you can give to this person who wants to build in the fixed income space and, wants to become a Web3 builder himself?
Yeah, so I'll say there's a two-part view for me of, how you can get involved. One is get your hands dirty, right? Go in there, try out all the boring lending protocols that are out there. Start with Aave, right? Compound, Spark, play around with Pendle as well. Pendle, it's obviously taking a lot of mind share over the past year. And try us out as well, right? The second part of it, which is that, read as much and absorb as much as you can. Funnily, we actually wrote a book on this topic. So it's actually on our website. It's called One Rate to Rule Them All. So if you come on treehouse.finance and you search the documentation site, we actually wrote a whole book about it. And we wrote it in a very easy to read fashion. So you don't need any prior knowledge in traditional finance or even in crypto. Yeah, it starts from the very beginning.
Okay, I know what I'm going to do for my Christmas reading now. So that kind of sorts a lot of stuff out. But yeah, definitely that experience part is actually something that I believe that it's such a primal and, given out advice that most people don't understand like how important that is, especially the boring part. I keep saying that you should always try out the platforms or the protocols that are A, boring, and B, have survived more than one cycle, because then there's definitely some meat there. Something that, keeps bringing them back again and again. So whether that's like Uniswap, whether that's like Aave, even like pub exchanges, BYDX and a couple of others, you may have your own favorites. Recently the Hyperliquid TGS captured like most of the mindshare, but the OGs of the space, there's a reason why they're still around. So I keep asking people to go back and revisit them as well. I think I can keep chatting a lot more, Brandon. But in the interest of time, I have like my final question here, which is like, who would be like another Web3 personality or Web3 chat that you would want us to bring on the Left Curve podcast?
Well, specific to fixed income, I think one, very interesting person to bring on would be Arthur Hayes.
Right.
I mean, he came from, you know, a fixed income background. He was trading rates, similar products to what I was doing. He writes extremely well. Would be amazing to hear if you can, I mean, to pick his brain on from a fixed income perspective. That's a nice wish list, I would say. After Hayes, it would be great to talk to him.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely. I think that should be one of our goals in 2025 and beyond, to get Arthur Hayes on this podcast. And, you know, maybe off the record, I'll ask him for some tickers as well, or what he's going to invest in next. Usually it's no. So yeah, that is all from my end as well. I think a key takeaway is really look into fixed income. If you guys are interested, again, check Brandon and his project out at treehouse.finance. Now, if you love the show, please do give us a follow on at RaiderBlog, and my individual account is 0xCyril. And for Brandon, his two accounts would be, of course, one, the protocol one is Treehouse Fi. So it's Treehouse with the word letters F and I. And the other one is actually the one that you can see on his on his panel right now, which is My Two Guys, which is his personal account. Thank you so much for coming onto the show, Brandon. It was lovely having you.
Thank you so much, Adonis. A lot of fun talking to you.